Hello, I'm Paul Cormier. This is number 0220, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, it's time again for another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0220. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet AZ Dungy, who is the actress and mind behind the web series Ask a Slave, which brings to life questions that were actually posed to her when she played a slave in Mount Vernon at Washington's estate.
There's a couple that I don't put on the show. Like, there was a woman who was very adamant that slaves used alligator dung for contraception, which was strange to me. There was a lot of questions about bathrooms and underwear, and then there were people that were just plain clueless about slavery in a way that was just so foreign to me. Like, I remember talking to a man at the slave quarters and mentioning my children, and he said, "Wait a minute, you mean to tell me if you're a slave, your children are slaves too?" I said, "Well, they're not doctors and lawyers."
Michael Harrington is the author of In God We Trust, which delves into the world of politics and features black political conservatives.
I actually modeled it after existing black conservatives. What I did was I mostly researched biographies and autobiographies. I guess some of the first ones I used were Shelby Steele and Thomas Sowell, J.C. Watts. And I was actually 2 years into the book before I heard of this guy named Barack Obama. So I did read his autobiography, too. He used those as a perspective. But I'd say probably Shelby Steele gave me the best insight.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. And this time on Book Banter, Hollywood said no. Plus a couple of my favorite showbiz script books. So put down that spec script and take a break from the writer's room. This writer's conference is happening shortly on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0220, was Paul Cormier, the production coordinator at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. And thank you very much, Paul, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, an international organization of maritime security companies says the music of Britney Spears has proven effective in warding off Somali pirates. A representative for the Security Association for the Maritime Industry says ships traveling in the Indian Ocean have found the pirates are repelled by Spears' hit songs Oops, I Did It Again and Baby One More Time as a result of their distaste for Western culture. The representative said ships blaring the music to ward off an impending attack found their security workers rarely had to use their guns. He said the pirates go to any length to overcome the music. Now, here's the quote of the day from the representative. He said, "I'd imagine using Justin Bieber would be a great crime against humanity." Actually, I think that might be against the Geneva Convention. Either that, or it would swing the other way, and Justin Bieber just might win a Nobel Peace Prize. Just think about that. Anyway, a Napier Community Primary School in Gillingham, England, allowed a man to pick up his 6-year-old granddaughter to take the girl to a doctor's appointment. The doctor prescribed acetaminophen, and the man took the girl back to school. There's only one problem. The school called the wrong girl to the office. The girl didn't say anything about being taken away by a stranger, and the grandfather didn't even notice the girl wasn't his granddaughter, in part because the girl had the same first name. The clangor only came to light when the girl showed her parents the drug the doctor gave her, and they wanted to know why she had seen a doctor. Gillingham MP Reeman Christie praised the school for implementing enhanced safety procedures while its investigation goes on for the lapse, and noted that this incident could happen at any school around the country. Yet, since it could happen at any school around the country, have you noticed only one school in the country is implementing enhanced safety procedures? Makes you wonder, doesn't it? A woman brought her 9-year-old daughter's birthday cake into the Cowlitz County, Washington Hall of Justice. She said she didn't want to leave the cake in the car because the dog would get into it and eat it, according to Sheriff Deputy Joe Connor. Now, unfortunately, Robert Fredrickson saw an opportunity and allegedly grabbed some of the cake. Connor confronted Fredrickson as he was washing up. "I went to get some towels to clean him up after I dealt with him," Connor said. "And no sooner had I turned my back on him than he was back on the cake again. And then all hell broke loose." Deputies grabbed Fredrickson and say that as he resisted them, the cake went flying. He was arrested on charges of third-degree theft and resisting arrest. A local store stepped in and replaced the girl's cake, which is kind of sweet on their part. Now, more often, criminals start with taking candy from babies, so, you know, it can escalate from here, I'm sure. And, you know, suddenly the dog in the car doesn't look like he's so bad, does it? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Mike Momani of Seattle, Washington, says his business idea isn't poverty tourism, but rather, as his website calls it, a course in applied homelessness, which will give tourists a new respect for the folks that find themselves in this predicament. The predicament is homelessness, and Momani's Real View Tours enables folks to live the homeless life for 3 days, including sleeping outside. Part of the $2,000 fee, yes, you heard me, $2,000 fee, goes toward helping clients get the correct look and persona so they can, quote, see the seedier side of Seattle in a new light and have an experience that you will never forget. Momani, who is 62, insists it's not a joke. He's a former computer programmer who has been homeless for 2 months and says his tour is meant to, quote, bring an experience to people they can't get very easily. A former computer programmer. How does someone like that end up out of work? Never mind homeless, what with all the computers we're using these days. And also, anyone who blows $2,000 on something like this is already one step closer to homelessness, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. AZ Dungey is the actress and comic who is behind the biting satirical web series Ask a Slave, in which one of George Washington's housemaids, Lizzie May, answers the burning questions of visitors to Mount Vernon. It's an absolute hoot. You got to listen to this if you have a chance. And AZ is on the line with us right now via Skype-to-Skype communications from Los Angeles. Hi, AZ.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. In watching the first season of the series, it's almost hard to believe that a lot of these are actual questions, but they are, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, they say there's no better story than the true story. So truth is often crazier than fiction. So, but yes, they are.
Now, as an actress, you've had the opportunity to be one of the, I guess, reenactors. This was in at Mount Vernon, right?
Yes.
So, as Lizzie May in your show, you get to answer the questions in any way you want because it's your show. But when you were doing this, were you kind of constantly biting your tongue?
Oh, yeah. I think if you talk to anybody that does that kind of work, character interpretation or reenacting or whatever it is, or even just museums and docents, there's a lot of biting your tongue because there's a lot of just outrageous questions that are asked.
So how long were you doing this job, by the way?
I worked at Mount Vernon part-time for about 2 years. It was my day job. Before that, I worked at the Smithsonian doing a show on the civil rights movement, and I had some similar moments there. So
in the time that you were doing this, what's the most surprising question that you got?
Well, I mean, if you watch the show, I think that's a pretty good roundup of the most surprising questions. There's a couple that I don't put on the show. Like, there was a woman who was very adamant that slaves used alligator dung for contraception. which was strange to me. There was a lot of questions about bathrooms and underwear and things like that. And then there were people that were just plain clueless about slavery in a way that I just could, that was just so foreign to me. Like, I remember talking to a man at the slave quarters and mentioning my children, and he said, "Wait a minute, you mean to tell me if you're a slave, your children are slaves too?" It's kind of like, I said, "Well, they're not doctors and lawyers." So, you know, there are some crazy questions.
Now, admittedly, since you were at Mount Vernon, it is a tourist location. The people who were asking what could be construed as some of the most outrageous questions, were they tourists from inside the United States or tourists from beyond the United States?
The tourists that were from outside the United States didn't ask crazy questions. They were pretty familiar with American slavery in a way that I was kind of pleasantly surprised about. I guess there was one man that was from, like, I don't know, I want to say he was from Australia, and he just, I was sitting there sewing by the slave quarters, and he just came up to me and said, "Excuse me, ma'am, are you a mulatto?" It's just like, and then I had to think about it, because I was like, well, I think I just said yes, because I, what do you say? You know, I was like, yes, and I'm very expensive, and I just went back to, sewing. I didn't know what to say. It was just so weird, and he just walked away.
So let's flash forward to your amazing series on, which people can find on YouTube, Ask a Slave. Going through 2 years of doing this, at what point did you say, you know, I've got a show here, let me do this?
Well, I would, throughout the entire time I was there, I would tell stories to my family, especially my mom and my little sisters. They were always like, "What happened? Any funny stories?" And then through telling my friends and family, they were like, "You should write this down." So I started writing it down. And then I was doing professional theater at the same time. So I was doing this in the day, but I would do shows at night. And a lot of my theater friends were like, "You really need to do a play or a one-woman show." But I didn't feel like a one-woman show would be really the right way to go, because to me, it's more about the questions even than it is about me or Lizzie May or, you know, anybody that is playing a slave. It's more about the questions. So I wanted to definitely have that visual of the people. And that's when I realized, well, probably film is the best way to go. And with my budget and with the type of material it is, I think a web series would make the most sense. And so I started writing that actually once I moved here to L.A. But it was definitely in the back of my mind for probably the last 6 months of working at Mount Vernon.
Was there ever any concern when you first started putting together Ask a Slave that you might get negative reaction?
Yeah, that was a concern of mine the entire time. I was mostly concerned about, you know, when I first started writing it, my impetus was to show me the modern Black woman having to step back and deal with these people, and the audience kind of being clued in on what I was thinking, because they knew that I was the modern, a woman of today, and had all this knowledge and had to deal with these crazy questions and in this crazy situation of portraying someone in 1797 and having to stay in character and all of that. But in the writing of it, as I was writing it and sharing it with my director, who's like a pro at comedy and at writing, he used to write for SNL, and he's a really great director and performer himself, he was like, you know, you can't, this, you're trying to do too many things at once, you have to simplify it. And he says, and the best way that it works is, you know, to concentrate on the questions and just don't explain like what's going on. We're not actually at Mount Vernon. You're doing a show and you're this person. And you don't have the second layer, which I was trying to put in, of me. So when that was taken away, then it became a little more difficult, because it became all about the satire. And this is actually the first thing I've ever written that I've produced. So I was extremely concerned that I just wouldn't be able to pull off the satire in a way that wouldn't make it seem like I was making fun of slavery itself. And that was a really thin line, and it was also something that I wanted to make sure that I stayed very far away from. So I think it all came because I continued, like the director said, to focus on the questions and make the joke never really Lizzie May or her situation or slavery itself, but to make it a comment on people today and the way we misunderstand this history and the way that we don't face it, and the ignorance and racism inherent in all of that.
So you've done the first season. It's out there, and you're about to start on the second one. What have you learned by doing the first one and the reaction of the first season that will change, if anything, what you do in the second?
I was so surprised about how people really seem to be getting it. I do see that. I was a little concerned about when we kind of meander from the basic question and answer, when we kind of get into Lizzie May's, people from Lizzie May's world, like the Emma the Runway or her son or the abolitionist. And but those seem to be also moments that people really get a lot from as well. And so I feel more confident to delve a little bit into that and bring more satire to that, to that aspect of the show. I think that's pretty much all that I feel much more confident about writing the second season, but I also feel a lot of pressure because, honestly, writing satire is really, really hard.
has doing this first season and the success that it's had, has it opened up any other doors for you?
People are definitely interested, but I think, and they're interested in me, and I, got a commercial agent out of it, which was good. But I think I still, this is such a specific role that I know that I want to do things outside of this role, and that hopefully that will open more doors for me, because I think because it's so specific, it's kind of hard for people to see me as anything else.
I want to go back to your Mount Vernon days when you with what you do in Ask a Slave, you get to answer in any way you want. Was it difficult? Did you have to stay in character when some of these rather ridiculous questions were asked of you when you were working at Mount Vernon?
Yes, I was required to stay in character, but that didn't mean that I couldn't use those moments to, teach. And that was my goal there, was to teach. It's not exactly like Williamsburg where you're acting out that time period. It's actually you're more facilitating, people learning this history from a more first-person point of view. So that gave me a lot of room to move the discussion in the ways that I wanted to. It's fun on the one hand to stay in the time period. But on the other hand, using the knowledge and kind of getting people, prodding people into coming to their own conclusions, I think one of the best examples of that is the conversation between me and the woman that was really concerned about what Mrs. Washington was going to do in the middle of the night if I wasn't there. What you see in the show is pretty much word for word until it gets to the part where I do the whole, why don't you come down the plantation and you can work my 18-hour shift. I didn't say that, but I did move the conversation to have her answer the question, well, what do you do when you need something in the middle of the night? So that she realized Mrs. Washington is not, some sort of demigod that requires, or an invalid on the other hand, that requires service all the time. And to try to get her to have some empathy for me when I talked about, like, well, I sleep on the floor next to her if she needs something, you know, and but there was nothing. It's just like I was saying these horrible things and she was just still concerned about Mrs. Washington. And I, you know, in those moments, I always wanted to bring it back to the humanity of the person that I was portraying and then also to some common sense, you know. So I definitely felt free to kind of provoke as well as stay in character.
When will the new episodes of Ask a Slave be out there?
We plan to have them up on Sunday, November 10th for episode one.
Excellent. And in the meantime, people can see the current season, the first season of Ask a Slave, up on your YouTube page. It's great stuff. I thank you very, very much, AZ, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much, Peter. Take care.
Actress AZ Dungey. Her website is askaslave.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0220, and you'll find the link. Check it out. It's hysterical.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey. Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of In God We Trust. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. There's also lots more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get back to the stuff. Eric Schock was a PE teacher at Chinook Middle School in Bellevue, Washington. One day, an administrator encountered Schock in the school at noon with bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, and alcohol on his breath. He was removed from the school and immediately fired. His blood alcohol level was estimated at 0.15%. The firing was upheld during an administrative review. It is highly likely that students observed his high level of intoxication, slurred speech, and watery eyes. That's what hearing officer Terry Luckins said in his ruling. The students in the district should not have to run the risk that he will have one or more repetitions of the same behavior. Now, despite all this, Schock is suing in King County Superior Court, claiming the district had no cause to fire him. While Schock doesn't dispute that he was drunk at school in front of the students, he argues that he should not be fired because he did not commit, quote, flagrant misconduct, unquote, as defined by state law. You know, maybe he should have checked with one of the English teachers on the definition of flagrant. And I know I've said this before, but how do people find lawyers to take these cases? That's the part I don't get. Anyway, this is a rather despicable story, in my opinion, coming up next. Brian Wood, age 28, served 2 tours of duty in Afghanistan, earned 2 Bronze Stars, and lost his hearing in 1 ear. Yet he still continues to serve as a sergeant in the Army National Guard in Peoria, Illinois. He struggled to find suitable housing for his family until he worked out a sweat equity agreement with Habitat for Humanity, and the process started to build him a home outside of Morton, Illinois. "We were blessed to get to go to Morton," Wood said. "We know it's a wonderful community. Unfortunately, some of the local residents don't agree, and a petition is circulating to keep Wood's house from being built." Resident Matt Summer, who is 56, said he was approached by a woman asking for his signature on the petition. "Do you realize," she asked, "that it's going to be made of wood, not brick? All of the houses in the neighborhood are built with brick." Leanne Schmidgall, who is the executive director of the local Habitat chapter, says she wishes the petitioners had just contacted her. "Construction hasn't started yet, and adjustments can be made. If we have to add brick, we'll do it," Schmidgall said. "It almost makes you feel you're not welcome," Sergeant Woods said. Okay, first of all, as the woman from Habitat stated, just because the house is for Sergeant Wood doesn't mean it has to be made of wood. Second, the petitioner herself appears to be as thick as a brick. And third, I'm also thinking that the petitioner has taken the story, The Three Little Pigs, way too seriously. Yes. Anyway, moving right along, extract of cockroach is a delicacy among some Chinese believed able to miraculously reduce inflammation, defy aging, and cure tuberculosis, cancer, and cirrhosis. Quartz Magazine reported in August that Hunan Province is a Silicon Valley-type business center where pulverized roaches can sell for the equivalent of about $89 a pound, and 5 pharmaceutical companies have contracts with ranches that have formed the Sichuan Treasure Cockroach Farming Cooperative. In August, a startup farm in Jiangsu Province was, police suspect, vandalized, allowing at least 1 million cockroaches being prepared for market to flee to adjacent neighborhoods. Ooh, there's a horror story for you. You know, right now, someone listening to this in New York City has just come to the realization that he might be sitting on a gold mine. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, I'm sure you have heard the old saying, "The law is an ass." Well, here is a story that really fits the bill. Donald E. Miller Jr.'s exasperated quote kind of sums it up. "It kind of went further than I ever expected it to." That's what he told a judge in Hancock County Probate Court in Findlay, Ohio. "I just kind of took off, ended up in different places," he said, after losing his job. 8 years later, in 1994, the court ruled that Miller was dead. Miller, now 61, found out about his death, and I'm using air quotes, 8 years ago, but only recently went to court to get the ruling reversed. Judge Alan Davis says there are problems with that. First, there's a 3-year limit on such challenges. Second, his ex-wife has contested the reversal because she and her children can't pay back the death benefits they received. "We've got the obvious here," Judge Davis says. "A man sitting in the courtroom, he appears to be in good health, but he says the law is clear and the death ruling can't be overturned. I don't know where that leaves you, but you're still deceased as far as the law is concerned." Wow. Officially dead, huh? Perfect. Now he's not obliged to pay taxes. Actually, you know, strike that. The IRS can get water out of a stone, so I'm sure they can find a way to raise the dead, too. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Michael Harrington is the author of In God We Trust, a work of fiction set in a world of reality. It delves into the world of politics and features black political conservatives. The novel deals with the issues of race, religion, and politics. And Michael joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've picked the topic. First of all, the book deals with black Republicans, and a lot of people would say, well, that's an oxymoron. But there are black Republicans out there. What made you think of doing this as a topic for a book?
That, yes, they are out there, you know. But that's one of the reasons I chose it. What I wanted to do was to use a main character that was kind of an outcast. So he doesn't really have a political affiliation that he really feels comfortable in. And in actuality, I base this on Machiavelli, and from 15th century Florence, who was an outcast. He was a very smart guy who wanted to be in politics, but his father was illegitimate, and so he had most of his roots to politics and to business were closed off to him, and yet he felt, well, but I'm smarter than everybody else. How do I, you know, make my way through this, you know, this life and try to be success? And I wanted someone who was, you know, basically had that same motivation. Says, you know, I'm not, you know, in the Republican Party, I'm kind of a token. In the Liberal Party, I'm kind of a traitor. And I just am who I am, you know? And he's motivated to go against stereotypes, and that's how he looks at the world.
Did you actually have the opportunity to either talk to black Republicans, or did you model it after actual existing black Republicans?
Yes, I actually modeled it after existing black conservatives. And what I did was I mostly researched biographies and autobiographies. I guess some of the first ones I used were Shelby Steele and Thomas Sowell, J.C. Watts. And I was actually 2 years into the book before I heard of this guy named Barack Obama. So it was I did read his autobiography, too. And to use those as a perspective. But I'd say probably Shelby Steele gave me the best insights. Sociology.
Your book also has some conspiracy theories in there, and I'm just wondering, do conspiracy theories play better now than they did years ago, because people just today seem to be more cynical about government and business and power?
Possibly so. I think conspiracy theories have always played pretty well because they're mysteries and people are, you know, I think as human beings, we're kind of motivated to, you know, try to figure out the unknown, even though it might be unknowable. And there's a certain fear about conspiracies, but there's a certain fascination, a morbid fascination to say, you know, there's some reason this is happening to me out there. There's some reason I don't know what it is. And I think that our politics probably has been heightening that sense of conspiracy, that there's an insider group and I'm not in it. I'm on the outside. And that's why, you know, things are the way they are.
You did a lot of research to put this book together, but now that it's out, have you had an opportunity to share it and hear from any political insiders?
Actually, not yet, because the book just came out on Friday, November 1st, and is available on Amazon.com as a print book and also as an ebook.
Speaking of which, you have sent this out as an ebook. Just the whole idea of the way publishing is changing these days. How does that make life either more difficult or easier for you as an author, and in this case, as a self-published one?
Well, there are trade-offs. I would say that it's much easier to publish books. E-books are kind of fascinating new technological marvels. The downside is that anybody can publish a book, and therefore you have a hard time, you know, raising yourself above the crowd. And so it's up to you to find some way to promote your book so people can find out about it and read it. And there are ways, there are things happening on the internet through blogs and through online reviews and also social media and things like that, which the traditional publishers are using as well. So they have to play the same game. And as an ebook, it's most of the control is with the author. In fact, almost all the control is with the author, which is a nice feature.
You are also a Renaissance scholar, and you mentioned earlier a Machiavellian situation within your book. Do you see parallels today between what's going on and the 14th century?
Yes, I do, because the basic theme is the same. It's the nexus of money, politics, and religion. And I guess in the 15th century in Florence, they didn't have much of an issue of race, but they certainly had issues of religion and politics. There was a lot of conflict there and wars over these issues of who was going to have control. And there was my first book was a story that really dealt with a religious figure who took over the most fabulous city of Florence and at the end of the 15th century and turned it into a theocracy, and it lasted for 4 years before they finally fell apart, and they hung them and burned them in the main square. So this was a very interesting theme, I thought, because I at the time I researched this, or actually read about it, there was the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which you had this Ayatollah Khomeini come back from Paris, who was a fundamentalist reformer who drove out the rich Shah and has established a theocratic republic. And a lot of the same things were occurring. They have a little ministry of vice, where they would go out with kids to find out who was violating the moral codes and basically arrest them and punish them. And this was happening 500 years ago in Florence under Savonarola, who was the preacher who took over the city. So I also saw parallels to the U.S. with the evangelical movement and the anti-religious movement, the secular movement in U.S. politics. So I think it's kind of a universal theme that works pretty well, and it's very fascinating to research and investigate, and then to weave it together into stories.
Now, you said you started to research this book before Barack Obama became president, right?
Yes, yes.
And even though the campaign can last for two, if not longer, years, the idea at the time of a black president was still a distant dream to a lot of people. Now it's a reality. The fact that it became a reality when you started to research the book and started to put this book together, did it change at all what you were going to tell in what is, in essence, a fictionalized story?
I would say not really, because I had the idea. I started the book right when I finished my other book, which was in 2002, 2003. And I started to research in 2002, 2003. And in 2004, I ended up with some other projects that were more immediate and more promising to do. So I put it aside. And I really didn't get back to it till, I guess, 2010. But I still had the same story I wanted to tell. And it was kind of interesting that Barack Obama became president, because people who have read this book and looked at it and said, oh, so is this the conservative Obama here, and this is this character? And it was kind of amusing to me, because I said, actually not, it's Machiavelli updated to modern American times, and most people don't quite get that, but it is kind of the way I saw it. And I think it's kind of interesting that the way it's come out now with Barack Obama being president, the first African-American president in the history of the U.S., it's interesting times.
The book is called In God We Trust, written by Michael Harrington. And Michael, the book is just out. Again, how does one get the book?
On Amazon.com. You can go to Amazon.com and search my name and the book title. You can also go to my Authors Guild page, which is www.michaelharrington.info, and there will be all my books listed and a link to Amazon. And yes, it's an Amazon. It will be available at other e-retailers, but at the moment it will just be on Amazon in their Kindle Select program, and it can be downloaded for the use of on any e-reader device. It can also be downloaded ordered as a print book and on print on demand, and they will mail that right out to you.
Michael, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. I really appreciate it, and it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Michael Harrington, author of In God We Trust. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0220, and you'll find links to Michael's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. The 2013 World Series is now in the record books, and as usual, it included a lot of close calls and controversy. But there was one hairy situation that wasn't on the field. Just as the teams were preparing for Game 2, the top lawyer for the Red Sox, that's right, I said lawyer, not player, received an unusual cease and desist letter. The American Mustache Institute notified the Red Sox attorney that the team's efforts to capitalize on the popularity of the players' beards through marketing violated a federal trademark they held. The Institute claimed that the potentially performance-enhancing facial hair worn by the players was infringing on their rights. Now, I've seen some pretty bizarre legal stunts over the years, but this beats them all by more than a whisker. Let's be fair. 2 years ago, the same group actually named Cardinals pitcher John Axford as its Mustached American of the Year. So what do you think? Was this just a tongue-in-hairy-cheek promotion? Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And joining us once again is indeed Stuart Nauman, stars in his eyes as he looks at those Klieg lights with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, sir.
Hi, Peter. And can I get out of the Klieg lights? They're pretty darn hard.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? They're harsh lighting.
Yeah, harsh. Harsh doesn't begin to describe it. I mean, you're aware of that. You've had your time under the lights, too.
Absolutely. So what do you have for us this week, sir?
Well, we're going to go into a book that's called Hollywood Said No. Now, I have to admit, when I first saw Hollywood No listed in the fall catalog for the publisher, which is Grand Central Publishing, I thought it would be a history of Hollywood's greatest rejects, you know, a companion of actual TV spec scripts and movie treatments by some of the industry's best-known screenwriters and directors, too, that the studio executives just basically turned their backs on. Then I received a copy of the book and noticed the names of the authors on the cover. I had to realize this was not a book about a hidden history of the showbiz capital, because the names on the cover of the book were Bob Odenkirk and Dave DeCross. Now, if you're not a big comedy fan, if you're not aware of them, they're responsible for creating, writing, and starring in one of the most innovative, critically acclaimed sketch comedy shows that ever hit the airwaves over the past decade, Mr. Show, which aired on HBO, and also sort of was responsible for discovering Sarah Silverman, actually.
Right.
Now, basically, Mr. Show has been off the air for a number of years, but it hasn't stopped the team of Odenkirk and Cross, with a little help from their friend, comic Brian Posen, to take their unorthodox comic approach and to sketch comedy and expand it into potential motion pictures. The problem, I guess, is that maybe those Hollywood movie studio big shots were somehow not quite ready for the comedy world of Odenkirk and Cross and rejected their film scripts outright. Now, what's what they decided to do? Instead of moping around and moaning and groaning, they decided to take a couple of the scripts and turn into a book called Hollywood Said No. Now, the content of the book consists of two of their rejected spec scripts in their entirety, one called Bob and David Make a Movie and the other one called Hooray for America. The first screenplay is a twisted satire of the process of how a movie is created from concept to final approval, and as well as satirizing some of the genres that permeate Hollywood these days. And the second screenplay is another twisted satire, this time dealing with the typical American success story, particularly how the most idiotic person who is in the right place at the right time can somehow transform himself into a cause célèbre and get himself elected as president of the United States for all the wrong reasons by a gullible electorate.
Well, yes, but you know what? We've all seen that, haven't we?
Yeah, and you don't need to fictionalize that.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, there's been several instances of that. Now, the book was interesting to read, and there's plenty of very strange yet funny scenes in this book. My favorite one of the that really stood out for me, is in the first script called Bob and David Make a Movie, in which there's a cameo appearance by Brian Posen as a street performer dressed as the Tin Woodsman from The Wizard of Oz, who totally denies he is a street performer and states that his silver makeup is actually sunscreen. But he had to go for the metallic one because he couldn't find the clear sunscreen in the drugstore.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre, but when you read it, it is the exchange between Odenkirk Cross and Posen as the Tin Woodsman. It's pretty funny, actually. It's pretty interesting stuff. Now, somehow when you read this book, you have to take these two scripts with the proverbial grain of salt and realize within the fragile state of movie and TV comedy these days how even some of the most strangest of ideas can land on the desk and reject piles of top movie and TV executives. Then again, with what passes for comedies these days, maybe what Odenkirk and Cross, and yes, even Posen, what they have to offer in Hollywood Said No could lead to a yes and may end up coming soon to a theater near you. You don't know.
I'm almost afraid to ask what other books are in the similar vein to this. Is there one?
Well, there are, I wouldn't say similar to Hollywood Said No, but there are script books. And there's some good Hollywood script books. You know, they have like scripts of certain movies or TV shows that are done in its entirety. But a couple of ones that have different twists with. One was, and I bought these both back in the fall of 1977. One was called, it was the book to the script of Monty Python, the Holy Grail, with different, annotated notes. And also some scenes that didn't make it to the final cut. One that had me really laughing hysterically reading it was a scene about a lunatic king called King Brian, which I wish they put into the movie itself. So there's like pictures and there's like original behind the scenes photos. So it's like if you had an actual annotated script that you were on the set with. The other one was the first book that was a tie-in book for Saturday Night Live, which was edited by Ann Beats, was one of the show's writers. It was published in the fall of 77. I remember buying it and spent most of my week's allowance on it. It was only $6.95 back then, which had scripts, some of the best scripts from their best sketches between 1975 and 1977, with annotated notes and, you know, deleted scenes and backstage pictures and what have you, and including a couple of rejected, censored sketches, including one called Jesus of Nashville. And you remember their satirical commercials?
Yes.
One that got rejected that was for Placenta Helper.
Okay.
And you know what? If you were a Saturday Night Live fan, you know, a devoted fan during those early years, it was a great book. I still have it. And if you could find a copy of it, please do. The cover is great. It's like a Duotang folder what would be a typical script, Saturday Night Live script. But on the cover is Generalissimo Francisco Franco, who at that time was still dead.
Yes. So the current book is Hollywood Said No.
Yes, by Bob Odenkirk and David Cross with Brian Posen. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's $19 in trade paperback.
And if people want to find you, how can they go about doing that?
Well, I say yes to this because you can find me every week in the Montreal Times, in print, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Stu.
Well, you get a green light for that one, Peter.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for a few more Stuff File news stories before we get to our idiot of the day. When entrepreneur Michelle Esquenazi was asked by a New York Post reporter in September why her all-female crew of licensed bounty hunters, entitled Empire Bail Bonds of New York, is so successful at tricking bail jumpers into the open, she offered a five-letter vulgar euphemism for a female body part. "It's timeless," she continued. "Of course he's going to open the door for a nice piece of bleep. The thing about defendants is, no matter who they are or whatever color, they're all dumb. Every single last one of them is stupid." Now, there's a quote for you. I'm guessing that, lucky for her, all of her bail jumpers appear to be heterosexual, too. I suppose, for those captured, it's all about bounty, no booty. Yeah. And we have a couple of criminals not ready for prime time. Number one, Tony Taylor was arrested in Chicago in October after driving off with a woman's SUV by convincing her he was a valet parking agent and handing her a claim check. He was detained shortly afterward at a nearby Nordstrom only because he tried to get cash refunds for items that had been in the woman's back seat. Wow. And number two, a woman notified police in Fremont, California in September that a thief had rummaged through her vehicle at night but had taken only a low-end gift shop item, leaving behind a checkbook, some money, and an expensive pillow. The item, she said, perhaps looked like a small bag of marijuana, but in reality was a novelty store bag of dried elephant dung. It's a great gag gift, she said. Yeah, two winners who could have easily become the idiots of the week, but they didn't. That comes later. Norwegian Public Television, which introduced the now legendary continuous live log-burning show, 12 hours long with color commentary on the historical and cultural importance of fire, scheduled a new program for this month in its appeal to serenity, labeled Slow TV. On November 1st, NRK was to televise live for 5 hours an attempt to break the world record for producing a sweater from shearing the sheep to spinning the wool and knitting the garment. A current record is 4 hours 51 minutes by Australians, apparently. In addition to the log, NRK viewers have been treated to live cams on a salmon fishing boat and for 5 days on a cruise ship, said an NRK journalist. You would think it's boring television, but we have quite good ratings for these programs. Yeah. You know, word of these ratings get out, and you might see a whole new lineup on NBC. Okay, a couple of stories we can put under the headline of lame. Two of them together, as a matter of fact. Story number one. In October, Jeffrey Lobb, age 39, was sentenced on several traffic charges, including leading police on a 111-mile Dukes of Hazzard-style chase through Logan County near Logan, Utah, with the explanation only that he needed an emergency restroom because of something he ate. Judge Thomas Wilmore called the excuse one of the worst he had ever heard since Lobb had passed several public toilets during the chase. And number two, Riverview, Florida schoolteacher Ethel Anderson, age 31, was convicted in September of having sex with a 12-year-old boy she was tutoring, despite her attempt to explain away the key evidence, hundreds of sexual text messages that she said were mere rewards to get his attention and encourage progress in math. Well, something in this story just doesn't add up, but I digress. And here's a quote for you in another story. Hey, baby doll, are you working? That's what a man called out to a woman on a corner street in Daytona Beach, Florida. The woman, Christina Ferrer, age 21, got into his car, then asked if the man was a cop, and allegedly demanded he touch her breasts to prove he wasn't. Unfortunately for her, he was. The good news is he couldn't charge her with soliciting for prostitution. The bad news is, because of her alleged request to touch her on a public roadway in view of other people, he arrested her on charges of offering or agreeing to a lewd or indecent act. Well, one way or another, she's definitely going to get off. And with that note, it's time, once again, as we wrap this program up, to bring you this week's Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
A man in a cell phone store in Pueblo, Colorado, was asking for help at the counter when another man stepped up to confront him. Why do you have so many phones? The man asked the customer. Are you a drug dealer? The customer ignored the man, but the man was persistent. He said he was a cop, so the customer asked to see his police ID. The man ignored that request and demanded that the customer, quote, give him the drugs, unquote. After a couple of such back and forth exchanges, the customer pulled out his own ID, and he really was a cop. The customer, that is. A detective, actually. And he arrested Roland Herrera, age 63, on charges of impersonating a peace officer.
Herrera is on parole out of Texas and has felony convictions. He is being held in Pueblo on $25,000 bail. Wow. Impersonating a cop to a cop. If that guy didn't have bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. But that's not the only thing. I mean, why would someone walk up to a complete stranger in a store, pretend to be a cop, and ask said stranger if he had drugs on him, especially if said fake cop already had felony convictions against him? Well, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0220. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0220. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.